Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
You always said this town was too small for you. Honey, I must digress. Singing so long, Miss Carrie Hernandez.
That's about a girl I met when I was working at a gas station.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the P-47s? Y'all like the P-47s? The P-47s formed in 2011 as an acoustic duo inspired by their love of old-time country music and 80s punk rock. Adding new members, Australia and America joined forces to create a sound all their own. The P-47's first full-length album, Stuck on 76, is available on iTunes, Amazon, and Rhapsody. Find out more on Facebook, Reverb Nation, and Twitter. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark Simpson was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi, and has played countless music festivals, including Memphis in May. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and tonight's featured artist is Little Rock painter Doug Norton. And our featured piece is this piece right over here, simply entitled Elvis, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Doug at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight's stories are all about Elvis, seeing him, meeting him, and even hanging out with him. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Jill Weatherly gets a chance to meet the king himself. And we'll end the night with Lewis Houston sitting beside Elvis at a hamburger joint. But let's start the night with Catherine Schultz as she remembers the effect Elvis had on her childhood in and out of love with Elvis.
My friend Linda and I, both 8 years old, sat on hard folding chairs on the damp, mosquito-y football field, watching the finals of the 1956 Miss Arkansas pageant. In those days, the Miss Arkansas contest was held each year in a different community. That year, it was Mariana's turn. Mariana is in the center of the Arkansas Delta, about an hour's drive from Memphis. Back then, it had no suitable commercial lodging, so the young women in the pageant were welcomed into the finest homes in Mariana. My grandmother's was one of them. Of course, we girls had been at our contestants' side constantly. We saw all the preliminaries during the week. Finally, on Friday night, the five finalists were named. Our contestant, our grandmother's house guest, was one of them. It was time for the big question, the on-the-spot test of the young women's personalities. How would they stand up to the public spotlight? Could they handle themselves under pressure? How they answered would determine who would carry the Miss Arkansas scepter for 1956. And then the question came, whom do you prefer, Elvis Presley or Pat Boone, and why? Linda and I gasped. We had been about seven when word of the swivel-hipped young man made its way across the Mississippi River into Mariana. I remember my older cousins talking about having seen Elvis at an Eastern Arkansas roadhouse. The way they whispered and giggled, I knew something was different about him. It wasn't long, of course, before Elvis became a national phenomenon, worshipped by many, especially those of my age, and scorned by the good moral folk of the 1950s. Linda and I were hopelessly in love with Elvis. I remember one fan magazine that we mooned over. The close-up photo featured his full, sensual lips. We died every time we imagined what it would be like to be kissed by Elvis. Now remember, we were second graders at the time. Staunch supporters that we were, Linda and I took it upon ourselves to challenge those who would criticize Elvis. We fought hardest against the rise of a rival, another so-called rock and roll singer, squeaky clean Mr. Pat Boone. Pat Boone. Ugh, just the words recall the disdain we held for him. To us, the world was divided. Elvis or Pat Boone? There was no meeting of the twain. Pageant contestants 1 through 4 chose Mr. Whitebread, Pat Boone. After all, it was the ladylike thing to do. Linda and I squirmed in our folding chairs as our contestant was the last to come to the microphone. Elvis Presley, she said, and honestly, I can't remember what her reasons were. The judges conferred and made their decision. Contestants 1 through 3 were named runners-up. Our contestant remained standing beside contestant number 4. There it was, good versus evil. Youthful rebellion versus stodgy conservatism. Elvis versus Pat Boone. The MC announced the first runner-up. Linda and I leapt from our seats. We hugged each other and cried. The only contestant to choose the king had become the queen. I continued to worship Elvis. In 1957, I spent all of my allowance and much of my time at the Marianna Movie Theater watching Loving You 13 and a half times. Through my teenage years, I saw all of his movies after that, too, satisfied just with seeing him in close-up and much larger in life on the big screen. As the movies made their way to television, though, I couldn't stand to watch anything after Jailhouse Rock. It was the waste of it. Clambake, Spin Out, Roustabout, all those one-word monstrosities that fall into formulaic mishmash. Girl Happy, Tickle Me, Harem Scarum. You don't even have to have seen this garbage to know how bad it smells. When Elvis went Vegas in 1969, he left me behind. He was not sexy to me. He was, well, too Vegas. I longed for the Elvis of my youth, now unrecognizable in the Vegas trappings he had adopted. I know I sound like a real fanatic. To be honest, I'm only an Elvis fan because he brings me back home. Back to where I first heard rhythm and blues. 17 miles from the King Biscuit Flower Hour studio, not too far from the crossroads, Marianna was where I learned that a certain wail of a saxophone could wrench my stomach with a yearning I couldn't explain when I was 9. It was an archetypal reaction, the kind of gut-level libidinous feeling the blues is supposed to stir up. I guess it wasn't until after Elvis died an unkingly death there on the bathroom floor at Graceland, at only 42 years old, that the sadness set in. My immediate reaction to his death was as a journalist. It was an interesting story, but not more than that. I had long since grown tired of the bloated celebrity in his sequined jumpsuit and cape. But as the years passed, of course, Elvis continued to be a story. And that's how I began to love Elvis again. Not so much as the fan loves the idol, but as a mother loves the child. It was the journalism committed after his death, some good, some exploitive, that made me see what had happened to Elvis. It made me see him for what he was, just another Southern child of poverty, who, despite his successes, never quite escaped his demons. He had some talent, and he had some luck, but neither held out long enough. Neither was strong enough to overcome the will of those who led him to squander his promise on silliness, and who stood by when he drowned his disappointment in drugs. About 10 years ago, I was strolling through a row of slot machines in a Las Vegas casino when I stopped cold. I heard Elvis's speaking voice, as if he were talking to someone. Hearing his voice in song was nothing unusual. After all, Elvis and Vegas are practically codependent. However, the newest version of the Elvis slot machine had taken snippets of his speaking voice and cued the machine to emit them as the player spins the reels. Computer-generated portraits of Elvis slid in and out of the screen above. One portrait even winked. I stood transfixed. There, among the other slot machines featuring the animated visages of Betty Boop and Monopoly's Mr. Pennybags, was the young man who had thrilled me in my childhood, who had crossed cultural and societal bridges and changed popular music forever. Now he was just another cartoon character, digitized and franchised, still putting money into someone else's pocket. I wanted to be back in 1957, sitting in the Marianna Theater with Linda, watching Loving You for the first time. I watched as slot players put coins in the machine, but I couldn't do it. I headed for the bar for something that would dull the sadness that washed over me.
Catherine Schultz teaches journalism at the University of Arkansas, Fayetteville. She worked in newspaper most of her career. Her stories have been on NPR's Morning Edition, The Splendid Table, and the BBC's America. Next, Memphis native Jill Weatherly follows Elvis and his entourage to the Memphian Theater and knocks on the door in Elvis, A Dream and a Vision.
On Labor Day weekend in 1967, my roommates and I were bored and looking for something to do. So we decided to go for a late night ride out to Graceland. We didn't know why all the cars were lined up along the street outside the gates, but we figured they must know something, so we decided to join in the wait. Elvis was in town. While we were waiting, the gates opened. One car, then two. Then three cars pulled out, speeding north. We all started our engines and tried to follow them, but they lost us. We went back to Graceland and asked the gatekeeper where Elvis was going. He told us he was going to the Memphian Theater, a small neighborhood movie house I had gone to as a child when our family lived on Central Avenue. Elvis was in the habit of renting it out all night to watch movies. The guard said, "You three cute girls could probably get in if you just went up to the door and knocked." So we steeled our nerves and decided to try it. I had been an Elvis fan since I was about 10. I had all of his records, a full scrapbook, and saw all of his movies. I remember people staring at me when I walked out of the Malco Theater after seeing Love Me Tender, my face red from crying so hard when he died at the end. I saw him in concert once in the early years. He was wearing his now famous gold lamé suit. I annoyed all the people around me in the balcony as I screamed. The day his mother died, she might as well have been my own. As a young teenager, I visited my cousin who was lucky enough to live right next to Graceland. One day, while we were outside in the carport listening to him on the 45 record player, Elvis rode by on his motorcycle. We ran toward the street waving and screaming. He smiled and waved back, seemingly pleased to be recognized. There was a pasture and a stable behind Graceland in those early years where you could rent horses. I remember being on a horse and being able to peer over the side fence at his house and even took one of its pink stones as a souvenir. As I grew older, my rabid infatuation waned a bit. I moved into an apartment. And then came the night when we knocked on the door of the Memphian Theater. To our surprise, we got invited in. We were wide-eyed and amazed at our good fortune. There were only about 25 people in the theater, and we couldn't keep our eyes off the middle section where he sat with his select few. We hardly watched any of the three movies and were thrilled when he and a couple of his buddies passed by our side aisle seats on their way for a pit stop. We decided to be clever and leave a few minutes before the last picture was over, since we had parked right next to his Cadillac. We wanted to get a really good close-up look at him. I'll never forget how incredibly handsome he looked as he passed by our car and smiled and waved. That was the start of a number of trips to the Memphian. Eventually, it became commonplace. We actually started watching the movies. We got bored with that after a while and quit going to the theater. One night, we drove out to Graceland when Elvis was not in town, and the gatekeeper, Bill, invited us into the guardhouse. A couple of guys stopped by. We spent many hours passing the time and visiting the night away. Sometimes we would go pick up food at the all-night Tottle House and bring it back to eat. I remember having to quickly fold up and hand over the commercial appeal we'd been reading when Elvis drove up in the early morning hours. Bill told us we could be invited up to the house if we wanted to go, but we had heard what kind of parties they had up there, and we weren't that kind of girl, so we passed. Bill did take us up in the Jeep one night when Elvis was away to get a closer look at the grounds and pool. That was a treat. But eventually, that grew old, and we said goodbye to our gatehouse friends. Years passed, and I felt I had outgrown Elvis as I was going through my hippie phase. I didn't think of him much anymore. Although, when I would hear a friend talk about his seeing him in Vegas and that it had been the best show he'd ever seen there, I did feel a twinge of nostalgia, but my musical world included names like Otis Redding, Janis Joplin, The Beatles. In August 1977, a good friend invited me up to Indianapolis to visit and work with her. She tended the plants at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. I worked with her for a couple of weeks before she took off with her boss to Florida on a buying trip. She felt confident enough to leave me alone to do the job for a week. By then, I knew the city only well enough to get myself to the Hyatt and back to the motel where we stayed. One night, I fell asleep while watching TV. I started dreaming about Elvis. I remember the dream to this day. Most dreams evaporate like dew in the morning light, but this one is as clear to me now as it was then. In my dream, I was backstage talking to Elvis as he was about to take some kind of drug. I was pleading with him not to do it. He said he felt like he had to keep going. I kept arguing that his fans would love him anyway. It seemed those around him wanted him to take the drugs or do anything that would keep their meal ticket going. I was in his face, trying as hard as I could to get him to stop. At that moment, I woke up and saw a newscaster on the television saying Elvis had died at 3:27 p.m. I bolted straight up, saying, "What? What?" I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I shook my head and rubbed my eyes and looked back at the screen. There was nothing there but snow. Those were the days when TV stations signed off at midnight. This was in the wee hours of the morning. I was even more confused and disturbed. That evening, I picked up my friend from the airport. While we were eating dinner, I told her about my dream and disturbing vision. She was as perplexed as I was. We didn't know what to make of it. The next day, I flew back home to Memphis. I spent the night with my sister, and still, the dream and the vision haunted me as I recounted them to her. We stayed up late into the night talking. The next day was August 16th. Our mother called, and my sister answered the phone. She got really quiet. I stared at her, trying to figure out what the look on her face meant. She finally looked at me and said, "Elvis died." My sister turned to me and said, "If she says he died at 3:27, I'm out of here." She did. To this day, I wonder why I had that dream and vision. What if I'd told someone beside my sister and friend? What if I had managed somehow to warn someone close to him 2 days before Elvis actually died? I knew then, and I know now, there was some kind of connection that I may someday understand. Until then, it's a mystery.
Jill Weatherly has been married to her husband, Jack, for 35 years. They have lived off and on in Little Rock for 20 years and have 2 grown children. Jill has taught young children for many years, is an avid gardener, and enjoys decorating. In our final story of the night, Lewis Houston ends up hanging out with the King of Rock and Roll not once, but twice in Elvis Ate My Hamburger.
It was 1954, the evening Mrs. Hollifield, Mom as we called her at her insistence, phoned to tell me a young singer named Elvis Presley was going to perform at the high school auditorium the next Friday evening, and she wanted me to attend. We would meet at her record shop the morning after and then go to lunch with Elvis and his road manager at the Ranch House restaurant. I hadn't heard of Elvis, but it sounded like fun, so I said, sure. I was 21 years old, and Mom Hollifield's record shop in Midland, Texas was my favorite hangout. Phonograph records had evolved from heavy 78 RPM platters to much smaller 45 RPM singles and large, thin 33 RPM music albums. Record stores like Mom's had listening booths where one could play and listen to records before deciding whether or not to buy them. In those times, recording stars, both would-be and established, dropped in to promote their new records anytime they were giving local area stage performances or just going through Midland, Texas. Mom Hollifield often called me in on Saturdays to have lunch with her and performers such as Slim Whitman, Marty Robbins, and others when they were in town. In return, I helped Mom with commercials and newspaper ads to promote specials and new record releases. That Friday night, I attended Elvis Presley's show. His singing and dancing were different from anything most of us had seen. His performance was received wildly. Next day, Elvis and the road manager were at the record shop when I arrived. After introductions, Mom Hollifield and I led the way to the restaurant in my 1950 Chevy, with Elvis and the others following in a very crowded, large pink Cadillac, which one could kindly say was well-worn. Mom and the road manager, a blonde guy, about 40, sat on one side of a booth, and Elvis and I sat on the other side. I took pad and pen in hand while we ordered the famous Ranch House hamburgers, french fries, and milkshakes. The road manager was interested in promoting Elvis's soon-to-be-released singles being produced under the original Sun Records label. I was taking notes as fast as I could. Elvis got up and walked over to a large mirror near the entrance, took a comb out of a hip pocket, and carefully combed back his oily ducktails. The rest of his bunch, seated in an adjoining area, got up and engaged in a lot of wink-wink, nudge-nudge, and snickering. No other customer seemed to notice them. The burgers were brought out. I was taking notes and asking questions so intently that I managed only a couple of sips of milkshake, while Elvis wolfed everything down he had ordered in mere seconds. Elvis looked over at me, at my untouched hamburger, and asked, "Are you a high school kid?" "No," I answered. "I finished college last year." "Do you play guitar?" "No, I wish I could, but I never had a guitar," I said. "Did anyone ever tell you that you look just like Sonny James?" "Yes, but I think it's just the hair." "Dang, I wish you played guitar. I'd like to tell old Sonny I hired his little brother to play in my band." "Are you going to eat that hamburger?" "I don't think I'll have time to," I said, and pushed the plate over to him. The hamburger disappeared immediately. We left a few minutes later. Mom Hollifield and I waved at the crowded, dingy Cadillac as it pulled away with its attached travel trailer. It was almost noon on a sunny Saturday several months later when Elvis popped into the record shop again. Mom called for me to hurry over to the store. Elvis, Mom, and the record manager were waiting outside when I arrived a few minutes later in my brand spanking new 1955 Bel Air Sport Coupe, the first sold in town. It was coral pink and charcoal gray with a custom Continental kit on the rear end. Elvis ran over to my car, and as I got out, he slid in behind the wheel. "I love this car," he yelled to the road manager. "I want to drive it." "No way, Jose," said the road manager. "I think he'll let us ride in it over to the restaurant." Mom and the road manager sat in the back seat, and Elvis sat in front with me. He rattled on and on about my car. "It's a baby Cadillac." The rest of Elvis's band and crew followed in a shiny new pink Cadillac, and a large truck carrying sound and stage equipment brought up the rear. The road manager said they were just passing through on the way back from a show in El Paso. The ranch house manager himself greeted us and ushered us into a room away from the noon crowd. A rather mature lady came in to take our orders. Everyone ordered the same as before, burgers, fries, and shakes. Elvis nudged me and asked, "Are you going to eat your hamburger this time?" "I sure am," I said. "Then bring me two of everything," Elvis called out to the waitress. The road manager told us Elvis's new recordings were selling like hotcakes, and they didn't want to lose the momentum, so he hoped we would really play up the advertising. Elvis once again expressed his amazement at my resemblance to Sonny James. "Old Son is one of my best buddies. He's helped me more than anybody. I'm going to tell him I found my long-lost little brother in Midland, Texas." I had my advertising notes finished, and we all walked out through the bright sunlight to the waiting pink Cadillac. Elvis patted me on the shoulder. "You call me when you learn to play the guitar, little buddy," he said as we shook hands. Something told me Elvis was well on his way to fame, far beyond his own expectations, and there would not likely be moments like this ever again. And boy, was I right about that.
Lewis Houston lives in Siloam Springs, Arkansas. He grew up mostly in Texas, is retired now, and writes a popular weekly column for the Herald Leader newspaper. A book of his stories entitled The Grape-Toned Studebaker has been published. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
We play a lot in a dive bar called the Whitewater Tavern. It's the Whitewater Blues.
Well, I sing about the plight of the working man, the best he can, but it's kind of hard when I grew up in the heights. Alternative country is a new big thing. Perks that church for everyone inside. Got the Whitewater Blues, mama. Yeah, got the Whitewater Blues. Drinking PBR like there ain't nothing left to lose. Got the Whitewater Blues. Well, I drive a Honda Civic cause it's good on gas. Ain't ever rode in a pickup truck, but I sing about the plight of the working man.
tend to know the spot down to my luck. Got the wild water blues, mama. Got the wild water blues. All covered up with them damn retro tattoos. Got the wild water blues. Way down. Well, nothing lasts forever, ain't that the truth? Nothing lasts forever, Lord knows. The bottom flout of all this tomorrow, I guess I'd have to drink back if he knows. Got the wild water blues, mama. Got the wild water blues. All covered up with them damn retro tattoos. Got the wild water blues. Got the wild water blues, mama. Hell, yeah. Got the wild water blues. Drink PBR like there ain't nothing left to lose. Got the wild water blues. Y'all don't tell me some of that.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.